Welcome, everybody, to another edition of ATL Alts. This is your host and creator, Andre Sandate. I am excited today to welcome Howard Abrahams, the president and founder of Morewood Funding. He's based in Long Island, Port Washington, and we're going to spend the next 45 or 50 minutes talking about Howard's background, Morewood Funding, and the work that they do to help businesses, particularly those who have not been able to or are not able to get financing and funding from traditional sources like banks, how Howard's firm and how his banking solutions and banking services help them. So with that, Howard, welcome to ATL Alts.
Thanks, Andre. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. I always like to ask my guests to start by just giving a little bit of their backstory. So tell us a little bit about you, Howard, and maybe go back as far as you'd like, but how'd you get to kind of where you're at today with Morewood Funding?
Absolutely. And just for context, in terms of tenure, I'm 54 years old. I went to Binghamton University, upstate New York, and then Cardozo Law School in New York City. Graduated from law school in 1994, passed the bar, worked as a lawyer during the summers, but during the mid-90s, when I graduated, there's a lot of action on Wall Street. So I went to Wall Street for, 25 years or so, mostly raising capital for investment funds. And I had the privilege of working at three extraordinary funds, one called Man Investments, which is a large hedge fund conglomerate out of England. Sure. Another one called Perella Weinberg, a boutique investment bank in New York City that had some investment products we were working on. And then a specialty finance company out of Austin, Texas, called Vita, now rebranded to Obra Capital.
Oh, yeah. At
Vita, we were investing in life settlements, which where you buy an insurance policy from a senior, so an 85-year-old, you pay the premiums, and then when they pass away, you get the death benefit from the insurance company. So I was raising capital for those funds. And then in 2019, I'd wanted to go out on my own, and I'd known a little bit about commercial and alternative finance, both through some of the work I was doing at Vita and also through some family members that were involved in commercial finance. So I literally started in 2019 and picked up the phone and called my local accountant and said, do you have any unbankable borrowers? And, 4 years later, I'm rocking and rolling. He threw me some business that was having trouble getting money from their bank. And I called the one lender that I knew who was a real estate lender. And they said, no, I'm a real estate lender, not a business lender. Call my friend who's a business lender. I called that person. They said, this is too small for me. Call someone else who handles smaller deals. And, today I've built a very large database of over 250 lenders that I work with. I source borrowers. I match them up with lenders, and I'm in the middle, and my incentive is to help get a deal done.
Yeah, that's great. Well, as I was saying earlier before we went live, I have a couple of podcasts now, and as I've been into this medium, one of the things that I found is there's so many subject matter experts in particular areas. You're talking about finance and the debt capital markets. And so what I'm doing today is I'm building ATL Alts as a platform to help educate, inform, and inspire founders and practitioners, investors around alternative investments, which includes increasingly a big allocation to private credit, right? And what is private credit? It's all these non-bank lenders, all these non-bank assets, right? And that can include a big part of your wheelhouse, I would presume, which we'll talk about. But it also, another podcast I've created is called Asset Backed, as I mentioned, and I'm going to go ahead and put this show on that as well, because I think a lot of the things we're going to get into are going to be very relevant to that audience, which is really directed to founders and practitioners in private credit and private debt and how they can go about accessing this quite opaque but multi-trillion dollar non-bank asset class, right, that you read about every day. So fantastic background. I would love to jump in and ask you, Howard, so you had this lengthy career on Wall Street and asset management, two really big firms, Man Group, Perella Weinberg, and then you mentioned Vita in the life settlement space. When you decided to move into alternative finance and setting up, your own firm, hanging your own shingle, you talked about calling on that network. when it came time to identifying, or maybe it's evolved over time, but how did you identify which types of companies you wanted to support in terms of the financing needs that they had? Like, did you focus on specific industries, specific geographies, certain size of company?
Well, I literally started by calling that accountant who gave me, you know, a particular company to try and get financing for. And what I realized is that a critical part of the value chain or the delivery chain would be the lender. And if I didn't get along with the lender, or I didn't trust the lender, I couldn't rely on the lender, I wouldn't be able to, you know, help that borrower close the deal. So the way I work is I built this Rolodex of lenders, and I have a lot of faith in each of those over 250 lenders. I've talked to all of them. I've vetted them. I've had discussions with them, and I can rely on them. I know they'll call me back. I know they move pretty quickly. And I know they're good for their word. If they offer a term sheet, they're likely to close. And so I actually work backwards.
Okay.
I start with the lender. And if I have faith in the lender, I'll actually look for borrowers that fit that lender's bucket.
So okay.
I am a generalist, but I think of it more as a solution looking for a problem than a problem looking for a solution.
That makes sense. Let's talk about, I was a banker at one point, and I remember the bank set up origination and coverage teams based on, sure, you know, industry, or in some cases you had corporate and middle market, lower middle market. But let's just pick up on what you just said. So you go to the lender, the financing provider, you have 250 relationships. Within that, you have a lot of different mandates, call it, a lot of different, sure, objectives for where that capital is looking to be put to work. So I would imagine this database is pretty dynamic. Can you give us a feel and a flavor for what does that look like? You know, yeah, is it community banks all the way up to large asset managers and kind of everything in between, or what's it look like?
So they're mostly finance companies. They're not large asset managers, and they're not typically banks or community banks. There are a couple of banks that have ABL departments that tend to be a little bit more aggressive than, let's say, a Chase or a JP Morgan, you know, a Citibank ABL department. But these are primarily finance companies or smaller funds. When I say smaller, could be as big as a billion or two, or as small as, you know, 50 to 100 million. Mm-hmm. And they're either funded by equity investors, limited partners, or more likely they have access to a line of credit from a Wells Fargo or CIT or Synovus Bank or some, yep, other bank that's providing them capital. And then they're relending that money out at a higher, that's effectively their cost of goods. And then they're, sure, relending it out at a higher rate. And for me, my sweet spot ranges from a million or two up to about 25 million. And then the middle of that, you know, 7 to 12 million kind of being my sweet spot. Larger than that, I find that the business typically has some boutique investment bank representation. And then smaller than that, they may not have their act together or be mature enough as a business to obtain even alternative financing.
Right. So they're very difficult to underwrite, or their loan tape isn't large enough, or whatever, exactly, the case may be. So I'd love to keep going on the finance companies themselves. So I think a lot of the listeners who are building businesses and have built, you know, small, medium sized businesses that are looking for capital, I often find that when they think about capital, the first thing they think about is their local bank. They think, oh, I'm going to go to my local bank, maybe where I have personal savings and checking account. And they start there. But I think what you just described is a financing company, is a finance company that it doesn't have branches. It doesn't have a retail presence. Can you give us a feel for, I mean, I've heard of CIT. I think some of our listeners would have heard of some of these finance companies if you threw some names out. So give us a feel for that industry. What does it look like? Is it regulated? Who are these shops, large and very established? You know, what are the characteristics of these finance companies?
For sure. And they do tend to have product specialties, and we can get into what the products, if you will, look like. But these are generally range from firms like SLR or Pathward Bank's ABL department that It would actually be fairly sizable. I'm guessing sort of 50 to 100 people. They've got an origination team. Those are the sort of business development team looking for the loans. Typically, my first interface with that firm would be through their business development folks. Then they've got underwriters. Once the business development folks bring in a deal, they sort of, you know, do the first cut and create a bit of an investment memo in conjunction with the underwriter that's giving them comments, saying, you know, we would need to see the following, or asking questions about the deal. The deal would typically go to an investment committee at the firm, and then they would issue a letter of indication, or otherwise known as a proposal. Additional due diligence, confirmatory due diligence would be done, and then ultimately the loan could fund in, you know, let's say anywhere from 2 or 3 weeks out to, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of diligence from the firm. Yeah, some of them on certain types of loan products like purchase order finance, you're really looking for very early stage businesses. It might be their first revenue or early revenue, and it could be a very small team of an originator, an owner. They could be the same person to, you know, a team of 10 or 15 people doing soup to nuts work.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, that makes sense. So in looking at Morewood Funding and how, you know, you present your business and platform, you talk about companies who have had a difficult time or don't have access to conventional lenders, which I'm presuming we're talking about banks typically. And the value proposition is Morewood will take them out to a much broader set of potential financing sources. What are some of the challenges that make them difficult to finance at the banks first?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we're in an exceptional time now. So I'll give you that sort of a general answer and then an answer that applies now, but more specifically, what is going on in the current environment? So, you know, banks are regulated by the Fed and the OCC. And, you know, I spoke to someone at Flagstar Bank today, and they have just shut down lending. I mean, Flagstar is a major, major bank, and they are shut down lending. They're supporting their current portfolio companies, but they're not issuing new loans. So that's, you know, specific to Flagstar. But in general, banks are really tight right now. And as a result of the Fed's audits and the Fed's limitations, generally speaking, the banks are not putting out money right now. So that's specific to this environment. But in general, banks need, you know, at least 3 years of a track record, 3 years of profits. There might be explainable extraordinary circumstances why a business lost money last year. They might have reinvested in R&D or capital goods, capital expenditures. So there might be explainable reasons that could knock them out or disqualify them from bank lending, but a private lender might charge a little bit more than a bank, but have a lot more patience and understanding as to the reasons. Additional reasons might be a bank might do a deal, might lend, but they might not lend enough. They might not. They might ask for too many restrictive covenants. There might be a structure that's not tenable to a borrower. I mean, if you take, for example, purchase order financing, if you get a large order from Walmart to make T-shirts, $1 million order from Walmart, and you've got to pay your Chinese factory $400,000, $300,000 to get those T-shirts made, you know, your local bank is not going to send money out to a Chinese factory. Yeah. But there are lenders that are equipped. They've got boots on the ground or relationships up on the ground in China to make sure that factory is legitimate, to understand whether the goods have been shipped or not, and better equipped on a micro level to finance a transaction like that would never get financed by a bank.
Yeah. So in how you built Morewood Funding, when you go back and, you know, you've done this now 4 or 5 years and you've built this universe of financing sources, what have you found is, you know, what are some of the important aspects to know as you sort of originate a new financing relationship? Like as you sit down with a new business development officer or relationship manager at one of these firms to say, hey, this is how I can help your firm, you know, identify good quality loan opportunities. What are they usually looking for?
Yeah. And by the way, it's never square peg, square hole.
Sure. Right?
Yeah. So, you know, even though a lender will give you their buy box or underwriting box, if we're looking for deals of a particular size in a particular industry with a particular advance rate, with a particular interest rate or fee associated with it, you go back to that lender, and for one reason or another, you know, depending on the weather, they may or may not do that deal. So you do need to hedge and perhaps show it to a couple of or three or four lenders to ensure that, you know, kind of work in parallel to ensure that that deal gets done. But what I'm looking for, as I said, is a very responsive lender. If they're not going to call me back within, you know, 12 to 24 hours, that's just going to be indicative of the way they're going to work with my potential borrower. So it's just not going to work, right? And we won't be able to get a deal done. So I'm looking for somebody who's helpful, who's understanding, who's willing to listen to the business owner and understand where the business owner will be, and really be, while these lenders are not equity partners, but will be a debt partner and supportive of the business. And if the business, you know, gets into a somewhat rocky time, the lender will understand and look across the valley and help that borrower, you know, work its way into a better situation.
And if the company is looking for its first loan or establishing its line of credit, or has a very specific need, like you mentioned, purchase order finance, that's one thing. What about a company that is looking to refinance and is looking to refinance into, you know, the environments are going to shift. We haven't had a rate move this year. I think at the beginning of the year, experts were predicting 6-7 rate cuts. We might get one. We might not get any. Who knows? But obviously a big part of small, medium-sized businesses is access to capital. And, you know, that access to capital being cut off, you know, for these companies, it could mean lights out, game over. So what are the different types of sort of mandates that these companies are looking to resolve? Is it rescue financing one day, and then the next day you're working on a refinance? Like, I'm curious what a day in the life is.
Yeah, I don't know the exact breakdown. So maybe it's about 50-50 of businesses that need money, you know, to keep the lights on versus businesses that need money because they're growing so fast and can't afford to support their growth internally. I'll give you sort of two examples. Working with about a $30 million in revenue business that has about a $8 million loan with their current bank at, let's just call it 7%, because this loan was secured a while ago. And they have an expansion project, but the business had losses a year ago and the bank doesn't want to give them additional money for that very exciting expansion project. So I was able to get them, they currently have 8 million at, let's say, 7%. I was able to get them an offer for 11 million at 12% for the next 5 years. And you said, well, why would someone go from 8% to 12% for the next 5 years? Well, the reason is that extra 4 million or 3 million that they're going to get at a slightly higher rate. So it's going to cost them, three points on, just a few hundred thousand dollars more per year is going to going into a project that's going to create them $3 million worth of profits per year once they build it in a year from now. You know, you put an exit multiple of, you know, 4 or 5, 6 times on that, you're creating, you know, $15, $20, $25 million of enterprise value, all because you're going to pay another $500,000 a year or so in interest costs. Yeah. So that's like sort of an expansion or a good problem to have. And then you have a business that, you know, for one reason or another, they have too much inventory. Their money's tied up in their inventory. They can't. They've got the wrong inventory. It's not selling anymore. It's obsolete, and they need to borrow money to make payroll. More of a rescue situation, if you will. Right?
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, as you have been in the space in the capital markets, you know, for quite some time, and specifically with Morewood helping businesses with solving financing challenges, and it even sounds like some strategic challenges when you talk about how to finance capital expansion and looking at an exit in several years, right, to grow the enterprise value, get a bigger multiple. That's much more than just being a quote unquote, you know, the old school term loan broker, right? There's much more that clearly goes into this from a, is there a consulting aspect to what you're doing when you get into these companies and really roll up your sleeves?
There is and there isn't. It depends on the situation. I mean, if they're sophisticated and have a CFO or internal or external CFO, they have a really good sense of where they want to go. I mean, they might be right, they might be wrong, but they're sort of tasking me to help them get the capital, and I'll lay out some options. Speaking to a business yesterday, that when it comes to receivables finance, you can either sign, let's say, a 1 or 2 year contract with a lender and they'll finance all your receivables, or you could have a more expensive but yet more flexible option where we call it spot factor. So you just periodically, on occasion, ask the lender to finance your receivables, right? So one is a contract for a year or two, and the other one is episodic as needed. Obviously, as needed, you're going to pay a lot more, but it'll be a lot more flexible. And so my job there is to, well, my goal in that case, it was only yesterday, is to present that business with 2 term sheets, and then we can go through and discuss which makes more sense for the borrower. So yeah, to that extent, it is consultative, but you know, I'm not there to tell them that they shouldn't finance or that they should finance.
Sure. Makes sense. Love to ask you about the increased use or non-use of debt financing for earlier stage businesses. I mean, we're coming out of a period over the prior 4 or 5 years, probably stopped about 1.5, 2 years ago, where early stage companies were having money just thrown at them by VCs and growth equity. That's changed. And it's much harder now to secure capital of any kind. And there have been firms that have stepped in to fill the void. What have you seen over the last 2 years, you know, in this uncertain interest rate environment with respect to securing debt capital for earlier stage, you know, growing companies? Because it's just become much harder for them in general to get financed. And I'm curious, for somebody that's on the front lines, what your observations are.
I am on the front lines of that and see that repeatedly, that you know, a few years ago you raised capital either from VC or from friends and family, and you sort of built your product, and let's just say that you are selling your product, you're just not meeting the expectations, and you're let's say not profitable. So now you want to either borrow money, but you can't really pay the debt, or you can't service the debt on those borrowings. So your only other alternative is go back to your investors, in which case you have to explain to them why you aren't making the money you said you would make, the profits you said you would make 5 years ago when you raised that capital. And it's unlikely that those investors will give you money because you haven't hit the targets, right? Unless you've got a really, really good excuse, or your name's Jeff Bezos or Sergey Brin, and you've got that level of credibility, right? But if you're not hitting your targets, and you can't service your debt, and you're not going to get your equity capital, I would say you're in big trouble. So you likely need to take a hard look as to whether you have a failed business model.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about, I don't know if you'd call them zombie companies, but sure, they've got enough to keep the lights on. And I was at an event yesterday where, you know, the comment from some of the bigger institutional debt shops was, in their conversations with enterprise CFOs, these would be kind of Fortune 1000 type companies, I have to think the similar thing happens as you move down market. The first thing that they're looking to do in terms of, you know, again, most of them are publicly traded, so there's a short-term pressure on meeting earnings and the street's expectations. But the first thing you do is sort of try to, you know, cut costs, but maybe avoid having to reduce headcount. So you reduce hours and you reduce shifts, and you start looking at then, okay, our margins are going to get tight, and how do we protect some of our margin? Well, now we've got to start maybe doing some layoffs. What is the thinking that's going on in not the zombie company, but the company that's selling? It's just selling into a tougher environment. There isn't as much buying happening on the other end. What are the financing sources scrutinizing today? If things have slowed down, and what are the CFOs and you, when you're talking to these financing sources, what's the narrative?
Yeah. So the real question from the lender is at worst is, what's your burn rate, right? How much do you have and how much are you using and how long is your runway? And, you know, the lender might lend you money in a certain construct, but doesn't want to get ahead of your runway. They don't want to be left holding the bag, so that they'll lend you to an amount that's shorter than your runway. And of course, runway is changing depending on where sales and profitability are going to. But that's where what you call the ABL or the alternative loan market comes into place, because there might be a more flexible approach to collateral. So for example, receivables, right? So if a lender is looking at receivables, they don't need to rely as heavily on the credit of the borrower. They're looking to the credit of the receivables. So you might not have a very profitable company, but you're shipping to Walmart and Walmart owes your business money. That's a highly valued asset. Sure. That a lender will lend against, where normally a business like that wouldn't be able to obtain direct financing based on their credit history. Same thing with equipment financing. Maybe you're a biotech and you raised a lot of money a few years ago. You've burned through a lot of that money, including purchasing equipment. And now you can't access the equity markets, but you're sitting on this equipment with no leverage, no debt on it. Perhaps you should put some debt on that equipment. And lenders will say, okay, this is valuable equipment. If the borrower defaults and can't pay back the loan, we could repossess the equipment. It's the same thing as your car, right? The car has some residual value, right? Inventory. I mean, you know, you could be sitting on a million t-shirts that Walmart only ordered 500,000. So you've got 500,000 extra t-shirts. Well, some lender will say, put an appraise the value of those t-shirts and say, well, I'm willing to lend a certain percent against those t-shirts. And if you can't pay me back, I'll take possession of the t-shirts and I'll resell them. I know where and how to resell them. And it's the same thing with purchase order finance. You know, if you've got $1 million, we mentioned earlier, $1 million order from Walmart, we know the factory can make those t-shirts and ship them to Walmart, so we're willing to lend against that purchase order. So that it's a creative approach to collateral and what collateral might be and what the value of that collateral might be.
Yeah, I'd love to get your take on having spoken to a lot of early stage founders and growing companies that are looking for financing. You know, there's always, I guess, surprise when they start looking at various term sheets. Sometimes the founder is very, very focused on rate and they don't look at advance rate and they don't look at the covenant packages. How are you coaching your clients in terms of two or three term sheets and some of the things that they need to sort of think about outside of just the lowest interest rate on the proposal?
Very much. Well, if you go back to that example I gave earlier where this person was borrowing $8 million at 7% and I was able to get them $11 million at 12%, I actually said in good faith and being brutally honest to that borrower, when I opened up the email from the lender, I thought it was going to be 16% plus warrants and it came in at 12%. But they were used to coming at mid to high single digits, and so they were shocked by 12%, right? And there we really try to stress to them that this lender would give them $3 million more than the bank would give them, which would enable them to build their new project. And to the extent that they have any other new projects, this lender would be supportive. In effect, this lender would be a partner to them, but not take any equity. And no matter what the loan costs, right, whether it's 12%, 16%, or 20%, it's still cheaper than equity if your business is growing and profitable, right? And if you think about your business, if you're going to double and triple and quadruple your business and try to sell it one day and you give a piece of your business away today, that's going to be a lot more than paying a lender virtually any amount of money.
Yeah, no question. And I often have said to earlier stage companies, you know, there's so much education out there about raising your venture, but there's very little around how to actually build a capital stack where you keep more of your company. You don't bring in as much outside capital. You have a smaller board And perhaps you think about using revenue-based financing or debt or other means, if you've got assets that can be underwritten. I think there's a real big education opportunity out there for that class of founder.
I will say, though, there's a certain credibility or endorsement or testimonial by having some VC capital. I've been talking to a business, a software company that last year did $15 million and this year did 30, is going to do about $35 million. And they're totally bootstrapped. And, you know, when folks, lenders look at that and now seeking some debt capital, when lenders look at that, they, on the one hand, you say, well, it's pretty impressive. They've gotten to where they are on their own. On another hand, you say, well, why did VCs pass on that? What are we missing? Or is the top line real? Or is the bottom line real? Is the model real? You know, has a VC or professional investor kind of vetted this company, or do they have to bootstrap because no one really believed in their idea? So there is sort of a third party endorsement by having some VC capital and support.
Yeah,
of course, if you hit a rough patch, the VC has deeper pockets and can support the business.
Right. Yeah. And they can be a pathway to growth equity, and then growth equity can be obviously a pathway to the buyout market or the PE market. I want to ask you about the relationship aspect. You know, banks always position themselves as being by the borrower's side and providing all sorts of ancillary products and services and solutions that banks can offer, deposit services, treasury management, et cetera, et cetera. What is the characteristics of the relationship with these financing companies and these, call it non-bank lenders, that are generally entering into the lending relationships that you participate in? Because, and here's the question, Howard, things go wrong. Things happen. By nature, you know, no person that's ever made loans for any long period of time has had a perfect track record. And it comes down to how does that workout process unfold? Can you kind of give a feel for this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, look, these lenders are private lenders at their own businesses. So they too are entrepreneurs. I mean, I'm working on a deal now where the borrower doesn't want to sign a personal guarantee. And the lender says, you should know that I've signed a personal guarantee with my source of capital, Wells Fargo. So I'm on the hook. You should be on the hook, right?
Yeah.
But to that end, because these lenders are also entrepreneurs, I think they are a lot more understanding than a salaried employee at a bank who's never, you know, made payroll, never, doesn't have their name on a lease, never contemplated a personal guarantee, right? Never thought about paying back capital because they're a W-2 employee. So I think these lenders are a lot more understanding and respectful of entrepreneurs and understand that there are rocky, you know, it's a bumpy road to entrepreneur to success. I should also point out that when you had asked me why what I do, I told you what I do, but I didn't tell you the why of what I do it. And I felt that in my previous career, it did get a little bit bureaucratic. I was raising money for funds with a fat card and a deck that was immutable. It was all regulated, and I knew the top 10 questions that every potential investor would ask me, and I knew the top 10 answers, and every meeting was exactly the same. Here, it is an unregulated space. I'm dealing with entrepreneurs. They're frequently facing existential issues where they need capital to survive or to thrive. And I have the utmost respect and edification, if you will, of helping these entrepreneurs and understand what they're going through. I myself have my own business too now. So I understand what they're going through and really respect the journey that they're on and get a lot of satisfaction in trying to help these entrepreneurs get through it all.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like one of the real value propositions outside of clearly helping the founder and the team, I would say make a market, but identify, you know, where's the best place for them to go to finance. But it's also talking to a set of talking to a professional who's really been in the trenches. I mean, you see a lot more deals than they do, right? The reality is, you know what is market more so than the borrower, because the borrower is building their business XYZ. You're sitting there all day. If I am making, you know, a simplification, is you're you're looking across the capital markets and you know what market is, right?
You're absolutely right. You're reminding me of that quote by Warren Buffett where he says, tell me where I'm going to die and I'll avoid that spot. And it's like, I'm spent some time in Austin when the scooters came out and
right.
happened to speak to a nurse. And she said, since scooters came out, we've seen, you know, a lot more head injuries in the ER department. So it's pretty simple. If you don't want to end up in the ER or you want to minimize your chance of ending up in the ER department, don't get on a scooter. So what are businesses doing that would get them into a place where they're desperate for capital? Now, again, half the borrowers I speak to are in a good place or have a good problem, which is they're growing so fast that they need the capital to support their growth. I was actually talking to a lender about this specific issue in a certain industry where businesses are typically growing really, really fast. And to support that growth, they end up taking a very, very high interest rate loan. And then perhaps that growth slows down or there's a problem in one of their orders and they're stuck with this high interest rate debt. And I said to the lender, well, would you advise these businesses? He said, I'd advise them to slow down. I wouldn't advise them to grow at any cost. And, you know, when you think back to sort of your VC questions, that VC cultures grow at any cost. And perhaps, again, if you're Jeff Bezos and you have a virtually unlimited access to capital, that's a good model. But if you're not Jeff Bezos and you don't have unlimited access to capital, you ought to be really, really careful about whether you can pay back whether you have access to debt or any other financing, and B, whether you can pay it back, right?
Yeah, for sure. I have next week I'm doing a lunch and learn with an accelerator, and you know, we're gonna have 100 or so CEOs and founders, primarily earlier stage companies, mostly tech, software businesses, etc. I'd love to ask you, if you were in my shoes, I have some thoughts about some of the things I'd like to talk to them about, but the conversation is alternatives to equity financing. That's the whole point of the lunch and learn. Yeah. You know, some of these companies are going to go try to raise equity. Some of them will, like you said, want that stamp of approval that comes from getting especially a very well-respected VC. Others are going to explore other alternatives. You know, there's been an increase over the last 3 to 5 years of things like revenue-based financing. We saw companies like Capchase and Wayflyer and Pipe and a number of others that raised a lot of money, made a lot of loans into software. And I know, you know, specifically in the cases of several of these software businesses, they ran into trouble. They didn't grow as quickly, and the financing models ran into trouble. When you think about the recurring revenue nature businesses of software and other recurring revenue models, what are some of the things you see on the front lines that lenders are scrutinizing today?
Well, in those cases, you're looking at both the top and then potentially the eventual bottom line.
Yeah.
And the sort of situations I've been involved with, let's say over the last 6 to 12 months, more recently, on the revenue-based financings that I've worked on, and they come in a variety of different shapes and flavors, right? One deal I'm thinking of was a venture debt deal. So it was a company that's tech forward, has a VC involved, has a good equity stack, but wanted to raise some venture debt. So I arranged $3 million venture debt financing for them, and spoke to them 6 months later, and their top line isn't growing as expected, right? And so now they're looking for a second position, right? So if the first position venture debt was, let's say, all in at about 14%, and that venture debt lender won't advance them additional capital, they've got to go get a second position lender. And there you're talking about very high teens, right? Because that second position lender is A, lending to an unprofitable business, and B, in the second position. So I think the most important thing I think entrepreneurs could do right now is to sober up and realize we are in a tough environment. There is capital, both debt and equity, for good deals, but it better be a good deal. Otherwise, you're throwing good money after bad money. And the lenders, just like the equity investors are absolutely scrutinizing deals.
Well, I was at an investor event yesterday here in Atlanta, and the last panel of the day was on the public markets, and three CIOs got up and all three predicted a recession, you know, is coming. You know, some people would say we're already in one, but not to dive into the macro, but the environment is clearly uncertain, and uncertainty is not good for markets. Generally, we have an election at the end of the year. There's a lot of geopolitical events that are happening, you know, in Europe and the Middle East. So all this uncertainty compounds what is already, you know, a pretty complex backdrop, if you will. So all the more reason, if I'm hearing you, why the company and the fundamentals need to be a good story.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, the debt investors are not so much buying the story, they're buying the facts.
Yeah.
The current state of financials. They're not, working with a business that wants to do a roll up, and he's on his third acquisition, and his target is $1 billion. I said, well, when you're talking to the lender, don't tell them your target's $1 billion. They're not impressed by that. And they're going to, all they're going to see is the integration risk, right? Tell them you want to make one acquisition at a time, digest it, and then you'll make another acquisition. Whereas an equity investor might have been a lot more excited buying into a business or investing into a business that's going to get to $1 billion in, you know, no time at all, right? So I think I'll also add that the lenders, you know, they do have a cushion, right? On receivables, they're lending 80-85%. On inventory, they're lending 80% of forced liquidation value. So there is a cushion, and they could withstand hopefully any downturn in the economy, right?
Yeah. On the point that you made about more of a sort of a sober, fact-based, fundamental-based review, I PM said to me at a big credit fund, you know, our investment committee does the deals we hate the least. And I thought that was such a sort of sanguine, wise way to encapsulate the credit investor mindset relative to the equity mindset, right?
Sure,
which is how big could this get? You know, is this a visionary CEO?
It brings up a really interesting point in how to talk to your lender, right? And first of all, I want to say borrowers should keep their lenders on a very short leash. They should charm their lenders. And I don't mean, you know, any sort of insincere and disingenuous flippant way, but be very responsive. Your lender is giving you money, potentially a lot of money. They want to know, the same way I want to work with lenders that are responsive, they want to know that they're working with borrowers, that when there's an issue, they're going to call up and the borrower is going to be there, right? The borrower is not going to be ducking them. You know, don't boast to your lender that you're going on vacation or you're buying a Rolls Royce, if you will.
Yeah. Right?
Show the lender that you're a responsible steward of their capital. If they ask for a deliverable, try and get it back to them as soon as possible. If you need to take a pause in the process for one reason or another, be communicative with your lender. Tell them, hey, I need to take a pause. You know, either tell them the real reason or just tell them that you need to take a pause. Don't lie to them. But you're building a relationship with your lender, and treat the lender the way you want your lender to treat you. Absolutely.
Yeah, makes sense. I have one final segment I'd love to ask you about in our final few minutes, Howard. This has been super enlightening, a lot of great nuggets. I want to talk about data, and I want to talk about AI. And I want to ask you from the perspective of what you're seeing out there. Again, I'm going to use the term the front lines. Data has become such a huge part of the underwriting, fact gathering aspect of what we are doing, particularly when you talk about loans to consumer businesses where there's, you know, lots and lots and lots of orders. Can you just enlighten me a little bit about how data is playing a bigger and bigger role in the underwriting process and the importance of data from a CFO, CEO's perspective?
Sure. Now, you mentioned in the beginning that this is a relatively opaque industry, and it depends where you are on the scale and size and volume, how opaque and or how efficient the lenders are. Now, if you're in, you know, sort of consumer loans, autos, or even mortgages, there's going to be just an absolute ton of data and a ton of AI to work with. But if you're a unique business and you're making T-shirts for Walmart, less so, and it's hard to really automate that process because, you know, no two businesses, perhaps unlike real estate, no two businesses look alike. Now, increasingly, there are third-party providers that are saying, you know, T-shirts aren't selling at Walmart, don't lend against apparel, et cetera, et cetera. But I would say that this industry is a couple of steps behind most other industries, or this part of the lending segment, spectrum, if you will, is still a year or two or a couple of steps behind where they could be in terms of employing AI and other smart learning tools. It's also the lenders skew in general towards older folks. And you are obviously a little bit less likely to use AI. I do sense that that's slowly changing, but again, a little bit slower than you would think.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is counterintuitive and perhaps counter to what you might be reading about.
Well, you know, everybody seems to be putting AI at the end of, you know, their domain now. And I've heard from private lenders and non-bank lenders say, you know, it's an eye roll sort of factor now when they see that stuff come in. Last question, you know, take your sort of former world, Wall Street, institutions, top 10 questions, 10 answers, and now this world, which is entrepreneurs building companies, you're relating to them because you're building an organization, Morewood Funding. When you look at the contrast, my last question for you is, what are the most exciting things about where Morewood Funding is today and kind of where you want to take it, you know, over the next, let's call it 5 to 10 years, when you think about where the institutional business was, you know, when you started in it and when you ended?
Yeah, I do see some parallels in terms of investment structures that I worked on, you know, back in the 2000s, I was working on fund of hedge funds, and it exists a little bit where we could create a structure, let's just call it a fund or an SPV, to invest with several of the managers. I've started to build a very close relationship with certain lenders. When I say managers, I meant lenders. I've started to build a very close relationship with some lenders who are letting me participate in deals alongside them. So to think about, you know, sort of a parallel to my previous career is perhaps starting to build a vehicle where I bring in other investors into those investment vehicles and let investors participate in some of these loans, which is really an asset class that for the most part doesn't exist and investors don't have access to. You might have access to sort of Blackstone's, you know, Fortune 500, highly efficiently priced sponsored loans alongside private equity firms where you're providing the debt to a private equity transaction. But in the lower middle market, the sort of $1 to $25 million, as you called it, opaque, mispriced, slightly inefficient market, there's just a tremendous amount of opportunity to partner with those lenders. And I believe that I've built or am building these relationships with these lenders where I could create a vehicle for that. So that's sort of one goal. And then perhaps, you know, as I get busier and busier, to create experts underneath me, one who's only handling accounts receivable, one who's only handling equipment loans, one who's only handling purchase order financing. So develop this team of experts so that we can very carefully cover any borrower.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating because the landscape is, number one, it's gigantic, 250 relationships. That's a lot of folks to cover, and the mandates are changing and the needs are changing and the capital, like you said, the dials are constantly. And then you have just the nature of the private economy in the US. The vast majority of the economy and the GDP is in the private, you know, company space. It's not in necessarily the public markets, contrary to all the news and headlines you see about the Magnificent Seven. So I think there's a lot of room to run. I'd love to have you back on ATL Alts, Howard, to talk about Morewood Funding 2.0 and kind of where you're going and get some updates on the asset management and the verticalization of the business. But with that, we're going to have to cut it out. Thank you for joining me today, Howard, on ATL Alts.
Thanks so much, Andres. Really enjoyed talking to you.
All right. We look forward to seeing you soon. All the best and have a great weekend.
Thanks.